Ah, the weekend, and coming up from the day's radio, one of the best jockeys on the planet, Rachel Blackmore's success at Cheltenham, the scars and legacy of the mother and baby homes, and breaking out the elbow grease for the big spring cleanup. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
People are saying she's the queen of Cheltenham. In tears watching, delighted people are getting a bit of joy out of it. Horse racing needs it.
Brain injury is challenging every day, so rehabilitation should be every day too. That's what I want to change in Ireland.
To say of gay couples, as this document does, that they cannot receive or express grace, to say that when at the same time you say you can bless a pot plant or a pet, This is not acceptable.
And why not start here with the return of Callan's Kicks, and Leo is making a new podcast.
Right, it's time for the segment of the podcast where I take a look back at the dark history of Sinn Féin.
Mm.
This is called Blast from the Past.
You're going to love my jingle.
Sinn Féin is so sectarian.
What respect?
Mary Lou, who are you? Blast from the Past.
Haven't gone away, you know.
So this week we're looking back at some of the killer IRA terrorists who were also prominent members of Sinn Féin.
Like Michael Collins?
No, Murph, it's not Collins. This is the bad IRA with the beards and berets.
Okay, and next week we'll discuss loyalist atrocities.
Well, let's see how we get on with these.
Excuse me, when are you going to introduce me?
Yeah, we were coming to you next, Pascal, so if you wouldn't mind.
I only have a certain amount of time. Murph said I could talk about the Mandalorian.
What, is that some kind of Chinese fiscal policy? Or
no, baby Yoda, completely pointless figure who's too cute to dislike.
No wonder you love it, dude.
Time for an ad break. Read the script there.
Oh, great. Did Facebook come on board after all my begging?
Are you kidding? But don't worry, it's totally in line with your brand.
Okay. Are you sick and tired of people screen grabbing your private messages revealing you leaked sensitive government deals? Wait, what?
Just keep going, man.
Say hello to Deliveroops, the analog messaging service that uses a network of underpaid drivers to deliver leaked photocopies that self-destruct after reading.
Oh, diddums.
Murph says,
gotta read the tagline, man.
When you need a leak, drop your files with Deliveroops.
Cool.
We can talk about WandaVision if you prefer.
Just get out. You too.
Aww.
The Leo Lens. In many ways, I'm just an ordinary guy, like no other.
From Callan's Kicks. Now, one of the best jockeys on the planet, the huge success of Tipperary's Rachel Blackmore at Cheltenham. Here's Cian McCormick's report from Rachel's hometown, Killinall.
Oh, big fan of Rachel from day one. Just so delighted for her.
Mary O'Connor is standing outside her home on Killinall's main street.
It's brilliant for the town of Killinall. It's brilliant for her family.
As you can hear, she's excited.
During COVID, it has lifted everyone's spirits.
So much so, she's decorated her front window.
Just a picture of Rachel coming in, and another picture of her down here, and the Irish flags. Just, we follow Rachel the whole time.
People here are proud of what Rachel Blackmore has achieved. Local man, James O'Gorman.
You're in the horse racing country today here in Killinall. Down the road you have Edward O'Grady's stable, you have Slattery's stable, and then you go into Fittert, you have Mouse Morris, and you have the Coolmore Empire then as well. With Rachel, of course, it's fantastic what she has achieved. She can hold her own with any of the jockeys, men or women, it doesn't matter. She's so strong.
A steady stream of locals make their way to and from John O'Dwyer's Butchers. First, there's former Tipperary hurler Donie O'Connell.
I've been going to Cheltenham for over 25 years. This is the first year I've missed it, and to miss it this year was just heartbreaking, and especially when the local girl comes up and wins the big prize, you know, it's a shame.
Redmond Carl, who's involved with horses locally, has a few words to say too.
Rachel is something else. She's got brains, she's got guts, and that's what you need.
It's at O'Dwyer's Butchers that I'm due to meet Rachel Blackmore's mum, Emer.
One strip line, yeah. And a Capri Sun, is it?
Its owner, John O'Dwyer, explains what makes Rachel a top jockey.
Rachel is very special from the point of view that she's her own girl. You need to be tough when you're up there, and more so when you're riding these good horses and you're expected to win. Thumbs up, top.
Towards the first, you know what I mean, Harry.
As we wait, the 1:55 race from Cheltenham starts on a small, tiny TV in a back room at the Butchers.
Quickly towards the second, Redford Road and Potter's Hedge are.
As the race nears its end, Emer Blackmore arrives.
The market mover of this morning.
It's not the norm for Emer to be watching one of her daughter's races.
Normally at home, I might have the race on. I will be pottering about, doing chores around the house, and I'll probably watch it from the three fences to go. But I can't watch the whole thing.
Over a half an hour later, Emer visits the local creamery.
This is Arthur.
How are you, Arthur?
She introduces me to Arthur Kennedy, who she says predicted Rachel would find fantastic form this week.
Arthur said to me that, you know, she's going to do it. So I was saying, oh, don't put the jinx in her, Arthur.
Everyone said that there was something special there. She was never nervous, even when she was starting off, being up beside Davy Russell, Ruby Welsh. She was never intimidated by him. She rode her own race and they rode their race.
We move to a quiet shed at the back of the creamery so Emer can do an interview in private.
Any parent would get nervous watching their child doing what she has chosen to do. I just want her home safe.
Oh, yeah.
Then yes, the child? Interview is interrupted. Emer's phone rings on silent.
Okay, that's amazing, pet.
It's her husband, Charles.
She won. She won.
What's that?
She won on Aloha. Thank you. Bye.
We're just talking. Your husband, Charles, has just rang.
Yeah.
It's now 2:37. What happened?
Rachel's just after winning on Aloha. According to Charles, she did really well.
Rachel has won the 2:30 Ryanair chase at Cheltenham.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm delighted for her. I'm absolutely delighted. It's just wonderful. This win today now will mean a lot to her.
You have a whole heap of text messages now after that last race. But, you know, what are people saying to you?
People are saying she's the Queen of Cheltenham, in tears watching. The phone is melting, actually. I'm so delighted. I'm delighted people are getting a bit of joy out of it. Horse racing needs it.
There's excitement returning to O'Dwyer's.
Yeah, I did. I saw that, yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic, yeah. Yeah.
It's applause all round for Killinall's hero, Rachel. And here, they're saying at the end of this week, they'll be singing in the hills of Killinall.
Yes, it's lovely around the hills of.
Ian McCormick's report for Morning Ireland. And in the afternoon, the hurt and frustration was palpable when the subject of the mother and baby home in Tuam and new notice boards placed at the site was highlighted by Joe on the live line.
I think a lot of people are totally unaware of this. I was until we got a communication from Annette McKay, who's in Bury in Manchester. And Anna Corrigan is there as well. Annette, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
How are you?
I'm okay. A bit bewildered and very stressed. But
when did you hear that somebody arrived at the site of the former Bon Secours home in Tuam, the mother and baby home, as it was called, and put up this big, is it a poster? It's a permanent kind of statement, isn't it, on the wall? They either nailed it to the wall or hammered. When did you become aware of this?
Somebody sent me a post from Facebook yesterday, and if you scan the pictures, I think I was sent 5 pictures.
Okay.
And it's the apology from the Bon Secours. It's Michael Higgins's apology. It's apology from the Archbishop. An apology from Galway County Council. So there's more than one.
Okay. And do we know who put them up?
No. So I, you know, the assumption was that somebody official has been and decided with no reference to the families groups that they were going to do this. I mean, it's just unconscionable that somebody, you know, would do this.
Now, the biggest ones, it seems, is, and they're professionally printed and professionally erected.
Yeah. Absolutely. This one looked like a corporate branding.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. Yeah, it's the Bonsecours Sisters statement. The Bonsecours Sisters is, now it doesn't have the logo, I know, so we'll find out from the sisters if they had anything to do. But it is their statement, the commission's report.
Yeah.
Represent the history of our country in which many women and children were rejected, silenced and excluded, in which they were subjected to hardship and in which their inherent human dignity was disrespected in life and in death. Our sisters of Bonsecours were part of this sorrowful history, and they go on. Healing is not possible. I'm jumping to the end. Healing is not possible until what happened is acknowledged. Do you think it's wrong to pin that statement to the wall of where the children, near where the children are buried?
Do you know, Joe, I went to that site first thing in 2015 and somebody very gently pointed out to me that where I was stood possibly was the sewage tank, and therefore I was literally standing on the spot where my sister was. So my sister was underneath my feet in a sewage tank. It was like a punch to the stomach. And yesterday, to see that somebody had the insensitivity and lack of awareness to put posters when the children are still there, the babies are still in that tank. It doesn't matter how many apologies we have. There's been no movement from 2015 to 2021. Nobody has informed me, as you know, my mother's daughter, Mary Margaret's sister, this obscenity will end as soon as possible. Okay. It's an open-ended future for those children.
Well, that's Annette McKay there. Then Anna spoke about the importance of keeping the site as a memorial to the women and babies.
I mean, they're talking about acknowledgement. They still haven't acknowledged what they did to my two brothers. And they haven't answered any questions from the police. So, like, this is 8 years I've been waiting, right? Mm-hmm. And I have the Chilean Babies family group.
Yeah, I know.
And we have 11 of our family members in that pit. And all we're doing is waiting and waiting. We're being turned inside out. We're being run around in circles. We had an excavation, an exhumation. Mm-hmm. They took the body parts out for carbon dating. They released a report by the expert technical group. Then they handed the land back to the Galway County Council, who came and backfilled it and put grass again over the septic tank. And now we need a new law to come in and open it up again. And we're supposed to be satisfied with apologies while we wait. And as Annette says, my brother lying there rotting in a sewerage pit. We haven't got answers.
Annette and Anna, we've just got a statement in from Galway County Council. And Galway County Council have been made aware this morning, I think it was by us, through your good selves who told us about it. Galway County Council have been aware this morning that signage has been erected at the site of the former Tuam Mother and Baby Home. This signage was not erected with the consent of the council, and the council was not consulted and had no knowledge of the proposal to erect the signage or who took this course of action. The council is aware of the upset caused by the signage and accordingly have made arrangements for its removal. The council is fully committed to supporting the full range of actions agreed by government in relation to the Tuam site, including appropriate memorialisation. It is essential that all actions taken in relation to this site are on the basis of open and transparent consultation. Now, the question is, who paid for these and who paid for their erection?
Sorry, Joe, you're talking about memorialisation.
Yeah, okay.
We've never been told about memorialisation. We have been promised excavation, exhumation, DNA, identification. We need all the files that pertain to the children, why they're in there, and are they actually in there, Joe? Or are they illegally adopted? As Fergus Finlay from the Bernardo said, that he was aware, not in relation to Tuam, but that death certs were falsified to broker adoption. So we need answers.
Annette, can I
just say that when this story broke, my mother was still alive.
Okay.
And you know, she was ill, but nobody knocked on my mother's door to apologise or explain how her baby ended up in a sewage tank. Yeah. And apologies come at the end of a long process. So redress, reparation, investigation, identification, even for us, the fact that the site is still as it was 5 years ago, and somebody to come along, and now, as you say, we don't know who did this. It's insulting. Mm. It's inhuman.
And then historian and campaigner Catherine Corliss talked to Joe.
Well, I was made aware of those about 3 weeks ago, and they asked my opinion, and I said, look, whatever goes out there for the Tuam babies, whatever highlights the Tuam babies, I will support it.
Okay.
Now, it was a very innocent move on behalf of a few very nice Tuam people who got together and put those up there and paid for them themselves.
Okay.
And I couldn't see a thing wrong with it, to be honest with you, Joe.
And what was their, when they approached you and broached it with you, what was their intent, Catherine?
Their intent, like everything else, as people are aware, there are vigils for the Tuam babies.
Yeah.
People come and they bring flowers. People come and they hang up. Even last St. Valentine's Day, a woman in Galway went to the trouble of asking people to knit little hearts that she could string together to string up for the babies. It's all for awareness. Every time something happens in Tuam, it brings the Tuam babies to the fore. And I know Annette and I know Anna, and I'm so sorry that they've taken this angle. There was absolutely no intention of offence. It was highlight, bring it out there. Because, as we said, we are so disappointed in the final report from the Commission of Inquiry. It really put everyone on just on a real low. And I mean to say, anything that will highlight the Tuam babies and bring it into the face. The whole idea is for the Bonsa Corps. I actually put that up on Facebook myself, because we don't know whether the Bonsa Corps are going to contribute any more or not. I totally agree with Annette McKay that yes, the Bonsa Corps should cover the lot. And this was a little effort for awareness, Joe. That's all it is.
And should they, Catherine, should somebody have indicated on the posters, because they're very nicely and professionally produced.
They are.
Should they have indicated who they were erected by? Would that have helped the confusion?
Would it have helped in it? I don't know. Well, I mean, if surely to goodness, if it was the Bonsa Corps, they would have their logo up. If it was the Galway County Council, they would have their logo up. I'm just after coming from the site now, I've just been in there. And there's a man waiting from Galway County Council, unfortunately, to take them down.
Okay.
And there was a few journalists there. And then again, I think that's good. It's highlighted again. It's telling the government and the Bonsa Corps, we're not gone away. We're waiting. We're waiting for something to happen. We acknowledge the apologies, but they're no good on their own. I agree with Annette on that. And we really need action.
Then Denise Gormley, one of the organisers of the signs, called Joe.
Well, I'm a PhD candidate in the Irish Centre for Human Rights. I'm absolutely horrified by this whole saga and the fact that there's hundreds of babies' bodies in a sewage system in Tuam. When I was in 1996, I was out in Kenya and a truckload of Kenyans crashed into a truckload of Sudanese, and I was asked to assist in burying the bodies in a mass grave. I wasn't qualified to do, I was only 17 at the time, to bury the bodies in a mass grave. And I thought to myself the indignity of the process. And I said, thank God I'm not from a country where this kind of thing happens. Little did I realise I had spent the previous 8 years in a school, 2 kilometres away from the site of a mass grave of babies' bodies, which are now lying in the sewage system. I don't understand for the life of me how this is still ongoing. So I have been involved. When Catherine's opponent came down to do the public consultation, the final public consultation in Tuam, I had never heard of any other consultations. And I heard the narrative that the people of Tuam were divided as to what should happen. I said, there's nobody that's in their right mind that could put their hand up and say that hundreds of babies' bodies should be left in the sewage system. I went door to door asking people how they felt and whether they agree with the survivors as to whether these babies should be taken out. Every single door I went to, one elderly gentleman came out and said he had no interest in any of those issues. But every single door I went to, everybody agreed that the family members should have their relatives returned to them and that it's a disgrace what's happened. So I've since been door to door in Tuam, and I cannot believe that there is people in Tuam that do not know these apologies were issued, that don't know the content of the apologies. There's people in Tuam that don't know where the site is located, And there's even people in Tuam that have never heard of the mother and baby home. So that is why these posters were put up. I've been involved in a group called As Long As I Can See the Light, who've been campaigning with silent vigils and candlelights and lights up. And it's just, as a legal scholar, I can appreciate the weight of the written word. Every single comma in those statements has significance. Every single word that's there. So this is purely information. It was not put up by the nuns. It was put up by the people of Tuam who have been campaigning for years.
And the group is called, so the group who put them up is called As Long As I Can See the Light.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And you paid for them and...
Yeah.
That's Denise on the live line with Joe Duffy. And in the morning, a really inspiring story from Rosie Mangan. Rosie spoke about a terrible accident far away from home and a brain injury that changed her life. But Rosie's iron will is a wonder to behold, and she was talking to Oliver Callan about her trip to Brazil just over a year ago.
I was in Brazil because by trade I'm an entomologist, so I'm a researcher that studies insects.
Yeah.
And I was there to collect the insects to bring them back to Scotland to do research on them. But then, unfortunately, on my second day there, I was a passenger in a car that was in a road traffic accident.
And that was in November 2019, so very recently.
Yeah, yeah. It was 15 months ago, actually. It's kind of mad to think that's how long it's been. Yeah. I've made some really good strides in those 15 months because I've got access to really good rehabilitation.
Yeah, and brilliant. We'll come to that. Do you remember anything at all about that crash?
I remember being quite nervous in the car beforehand because I thought the drivers on the road were a bit haphazard. Yeah. And I actually remember texting my fiancé at the time and saying that I was quite scared. And he showed me that message more recently. I was like, God, I wasn't imagining that it really was dangerous.
It really was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's lucky you're talking to us at all today, but you don't remember really much. What are your memories of what happens afterwards?
Well, I got put into a medically induced coma and I don't really remember too much of that time except when they stopped the sedation. And then I guess I've gotten coming to slowly but surely. And I really remember hearing my boss Luke's voice, my mum's voice, my sister's voice and Connor's voice. And then my friends all sent voice notes to Connor and my mum and they were playing them all the time. And I think especially when the sedation got stopped, my family were kind of screaming at me to wake up all the time and to open my eyes. I remember the Brazilian nurses kept shouting, "Open your big blue eyes, Jose Mary," every day. And I got a bit fed up with that because I couldn't open my eyes.
But what's incredible is that you have a memory of that even though you're in a coma, and to anyone looking on, they were wondering whether you could hear anything.
Yeah. I think that was encouraged to my family to talk to me constantly.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's kind of an altered state of consciousness. So you're gradually waking up.
It's incredible. And Connor, we should say, is your fiancé.
Yeah.
But your mum flew out pretty much straight away.
Yeah, my mum and Connor flew out straight away. And then my sister followed, I think, a week and a half later.
And they get you home.
Yeah, I flew home in an air ambulance with my mum. It's probably the only private flight I'll ever be on, and I was fast asleep for the whole thing.
Okay, right. The coma went on, and then you came home. And we should say, by the way, because you were over there, you weren't over as a holidaymaker. You were, as you say, an entomologist doing something quite serious. You were fully insured and everything to be treated and get home. What do you remember then when you get into the Mater Hospital, and then it's your father's voice you're hearing?
Yeah, that's when I knew something had changed because I couldn't hear any Portuguese anymore. And I remember hearing my dad's voice. And that was like, I knew something was different. And I was like, wait a second, Dad's here. And then when I really started to fight to wake up. And sure enough, I'm not sure of the exact days, but I woke up about a week. I think it was a day or two later, I started making hand movements. And Connor said I finally started smiling because I had a massive grimace on my face the whole time I was in Brazil. I started smiling. And then there was a tracheostomy going into my lungs so it could help me breathe. But then when I woke up from my coma, I was really agitated. I just wanted to get rid of that.
and I tried to pull it out a few times. So I have to say to the poor nurses that were looking after me, I must have been a nightmare.
But it's interesting, you remember the fight that you were battling to wake up.
Yeah. Connor said one of the last things I did before we left Brazil, I couldn't speak, but I was mouthing to him, help me, help me. Wow. And I think I just knew that I wanted to get better from straight away when I woke up. I was like, this is not going to beat me.
So what was Rosie's family told about her prognosis?
Well, I don't know what the medical term is, but I think I would describe it as I was pretty goosed.
Yeah.
I didn't look great, but yes, yeah, I mean, there's lots of lesions on my brain. I couldn't breathe and vent, and a lot of my muscles, I couldn't move them anymore. So my left side, it was completely weakened.
Yeah.
And I guess then the different pieces of damage on different parts of the brain, they impact your emotions, your ability to communicate. Just, it's very complex. But then getting help in hospital and later in rehabilitation helped me overcome all those challenges.
I mean, you sounded amazing today, considering that at the time the doctors weren't even sure whether you would be able to talk if you woke up. How long has it been since your discharge, since you were left out of the matter?
I left the matter on the 20th of March 2019, so a year ago. And then I went to the Specialist Rehabilitation Unit in the National Orthopaedic Hospital in Kappa.
Yeah.
And I was there for 7 months. And since I've come home, I've been working with Acquired Brain Injury Ireland and the Community Rehabilitation with the HSC. And we're very lucky here in Taoiseach because it's excellent service. But unfortunately, that's not the same around Ireland. And that's something I'm trying to campaign to change now.
Yeah. Because there's quite a lot of brain injuries every year in this country, isn't it, that we probably don't hear enough about?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact numbers.
19,000, it says here in front of me, and that's the number from Acquired Brain Injuries Ireland. And it is Brain Awareness Week, so this is the campaign to spread awareness. I mean, tell us how fortunate you were in terms of the treatment that you got. If you bring us back to those days, it's only a year ago tomorrow. The rest of us were trying to cope with lockdown. You were coping with getting your life back and getting almost every facet of your life back.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about when I got to a rehabilitation unit.
Yeah.
I couldn't sit up in a chair for more than 2 hours.
Right.
Because it was so painful. I couldn't walk. But, you know, 7 months later, I was walking. I mean, I'm still not walking perfectly independently, but that was a great stride to make in 7 months. And I couldn't speak for long periods of time, but I learned how to give lectures, which I used to do in my job in Scotland. And I've actually spoken at 2 conferences since I've left hospital this year.
Wow.
And I think that's a really good example of the great strides brain injury survivors can make if they have access to services at the right time.
Yeah.
And I definitely put services as one of the 3 things that have been really fundamental to my recovery. I'd also say I'm as stubborn as they come, so being stubborn definitely helps. And I've had great family and friends support too as well.
And Rosie spoke about the importance of specialist treatment and rehabilitation, which isn't available to everyone.
Unfortunately, it's not. Mm. And that's something I'm really trying to change at the moment. I wrote a letter to the President of Ireland,
yes,
Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, Stephen Donnelly. I'm sure he's probably sick of hearing from me, but I'm really campaigning that if neurorehabilitation is available throughout the community for everybody, everybody can make great strides to change and they can live their life to its full potential.
And the early intervention, you say, is really important.
Absolutely.
Do you sign those letters, yours, Stubborn Rosie? And they go, oh yeah, there's Rosie again.
I think just when I think about the friends I made while I was in Kappa in the Specialist Rehabilitation Unit, and like a bunch of people, were like myself, Andy, John, Kathleen, Eileen, we've all made great strides because we got access to timely rehabilitation.
Yeah.
And that should be the case for everybody. Because only 9% of patients with brain injury get moved into rehabilitation. But I'm determined to turn that 9% into 100%.
Yeah. Where are you at the moment, Rosie?
I'm in my parents' house in County Offaly.
Lovely. So you moved back in with your parents.
Yes.
And, I mean, what is your day-to-day life? What kind of difficulties are you facing now?
I'm just still trying to learn to walk independently. Mm-hmm. And I have to exercise extreme patience because it's a slow, steady race. As my rehabilitation consultant says, Rosie, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And yeah, he's dead right.
Some people might be driven mad by those things because we're not the most patient crowd, given the way the world has kind of constantly told us to keep moving forward. But you managed to prepare yourself, I suppose, for that battle.
Well, I do have to be honest. I have days where I'm sitting in my room and I'm swearing cathartically like it's going out of fashion. Yeah. And then you have other days where it just goes smoothly and you have a win and you're like, yes, that worked today.
Very good. It's those little battles, little victories, yeah, along the way. A bit of shouting out loud. That does no harm.
Lots of swearing every so often.
We could add that one too. Stubborn, sweary Rosie. So the main reason you're talking to us today is you want all these opportunities, don't you, for brain injury survivors in this country?
Yes, absolutely.
What are the three things you think have been vital for you on this trip?
Access to services is number one. Mm-hmm. And timely access to services. Because rehabilitation is challenging every day. Well, I mean, brain injury is challenging every day. So rehabilitation should be every day too. And that's what I want to change in Ireland.
Well, look, we listen we hear you loud and clear, Rosie. As you say, it was a life-changing injury, but the key word is life, that you're yeah, still alive. And do you think about the person you were, or do you just look ahead? How do you get through that bit?
I've spoken to my psychologist, Brian, about this, and I don't find myself angry about the things I can change. But the crash has happened now. But you know what I can change? I can change my recovery going forward. And if I approach it with an enthusiastic and motivated, but if I approach it in that way, it's going to be so much more fun for me and the people I'm working with. And I generally, I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I don't think they're too unhappy being in my company. At least I hope not.
I wouldn't say so. That's Rosie Mangan talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. Plans for the weekend? Well, I'm getting the sugar soap out for an epic clean-up to get ready for painting everywhere. I've obviously got the spring clean fever. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Tanya Lee Conroy and Catherine Carton, we're talking about sprucing up your home.
Tanya, I'm going to start with you because it can be a daunting task, can't it, when you say to yourself, I have to clean the whole house from top to bottom. Have you any advice on how to tackle it?
It sure can be a daunting task, Claire. And I suppose the thing is for people not to let it overwhelm you, I think. So probably my top tip would be little and often. So, bit by bit, day by day, and then by the time you've got around the whole house, it's time to start again.
Yeah, that's the problem with it, isn't it? But rather than saying you've got this entire thing to do and it's going to take me 3 days, you're saying pick maybe one job a day and try and get that done.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, like I do the beds on a Thursday. I do the floors, mop all the floors on a Friday, the bathrooms on a Monday. So things like that. And then I'll pick maybe the first day of each month to do like clean out the microwave or just down the shelves, things like that.
Yeah, but you do certain jobs every day. And you say one of the invaluable tools that you have is the cordless vacuum.
I can't live without it. It is literally like the new sweeping brush to me anyway. You know, after a family meal, I'll whip it out and clean under the table. We've just got a new puppy and she's quite hairy. So, whip it out and on the sofa and it's done. One with the cord, you know, you think twice about taking it out, but cordless, it's just easy.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And yeah, it's there all the time. And of course, the dog hair is a big problem for anyone
sure
who has
is.
A pet. Keeping areas clutter free. Your advice is to have a drawer that you use for clutter and don't let it bother you.
Exactly. So I have a Monica drawer. So like Monica and Friends, she had one room that, you know, she never let anyone in because it was messy. But I have a drawer in a kitchen like that. And like I throw, you know, letters in it, or, you know, there might be, you know, envelopes or cards or whatever thrown into it. And every so often then I'll go through it, but not to let it get to you. And that, you know, let that be your messy part. But also, For areas that will have clutter, like say for us, for instance, it's the back door. That's the high traffic area. So instead of, you know, walking in the door and having loads of shoes on the ground or coats thrown everywhere, I'll have a basket there. I'll have a shoe rack and coat hooks so that, you know, there's a place for everything. Yeah. So that you're not coming in the door.
How do you convince the people that are coming in the back door to use those things? That's the question that I have.
I know.
Because I have that, I have that going on as well. But more often than not, everything's thrown on the floor or on beside the sink.
Yeah, the odd drawer doesn't turn.
Catherine, good morning to you. You're going to talk to us about sprucing up for spring, and you think it's the perfect opportunity at this time of the year to just start moving things around a bit.
Yeah, so I always say, do you remember when you were like a teenager and you'd rearrange your bedroom and all of a sudden you would be so proud and it would feel like a brand new space?
Yeah.
So you can kind of do that with areas like in your house. So maybe if you have a look at areas that maybe there's like a chair that's like blocking a window, or sometimes like there might be a door that's kind of blocked and the house kind of just feels like it needs to breathe. So it's a great time to kind of have a look and be like, you know, do I need like a coffee table like that big, or can I put that chair in another room? And just by kind of moving things around, like I'm not a feng shui expert at all, but I find it just kind of lifts up that energy and it can make a space feel like new again.
And then how do you deal with the clutter problem? Because rather than moving it into another area like the Monica drawer, you think that you should put in structures to deal with it.
Yes. So if there's like corners of the house, because I know myself, especially with working from home and being at home a lot, clutter actually kind of affects like my kind of my headspace. So I do try and identify the corners that are getting cluttered. So if it's the hallway or if it's like certain parts, and I just try and identify the problem and come up with a solution. So it might be something simple as just having an extra laundry basket, because as I'm speaking to you, I'm looking at the chair and the chair is full of all of the washing. So little things like that, just to kind of hide it almost. But yeah, find the problem area and try and come up with a solution. So it might just need shelving, it might just need baskets, or you might just need to pin out on some of the items that you have.
Catherine Carton and Tanya Lee Conroy from Today with Claire Byrne. And on Morning Ireland, the Vatican Authorities paper on the blessing of same-sex unions. Here's Anya Lawler.
Former President Mary McAleese is among those criticising Pope Francis after the Vatican upheld a ban on the blessing of same-sex marriages or unions earlier this week, ruling they were not valid. The Association of Catholic Priests has called the decision divisive and showing breathtaking certainty about what God can and cannot do. Father Tim Hazelwood from the Association is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
When you say the Vatican is showing breathtaking certainty in their assumptions about what God can and cannot do, what do you mean in this context?
Well, just to explain firstly that I am not a moral theologian. I'm a priest working in a parish here in East Cork. So I suppose we work from, most of us who are involved in the association work from our experience of working and meeting and just interacting with people within the parish. And that includes people and families who have somebody who's in a same-sex relationship. And our experience is that, you know, they're lovely couples. And to hear something like that, you know, that their relationship is sinful, like that's, like, I wonder how many of them know and meet and interact with those families and those people. But I think there's a deeper issue, I think, involved here, if you don't mind me explaining a little bit about what's going on. Pope Francis has introduced this synodality way forward for the church, which means that issues are now going to be brought to the surface. And that is, it's coming at the moment from a synod that's being held in Germany, where the German bishops have said, some of them openly, mm-hmm. that they are going to be blessing same-sex unions. So obviously some complained to Rome, and that was sent to the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith, and they have come out with this. So Pope Francis is in a very difficult position, because you have a whole group within the church who would back what the congregation are saying, and then there are others who have a different view, and Pope Francis is trying to balance both, and it's very difficult. He has said some very positive things about inclusiveness and including gay people in, you know, and people, all peoples on the margins involved in what's going on in the church. But to listen to that statement, it was so disappointing, and it was appalling, really.
Mary McAleese says Pope Francis has raised hopes, but he toes the old hard line. Do you agree?
The words come out that way, but I'm not in the position where I have to hold all the parts together. He's trying, like, in parts of the world, including especially in the United States, and we even here in Ireland, like, we would have a very hardcore group who would be very anti-Pope Francis and anti the changes and the new breath of life that he's bringing. And I can understand where Mary McAleese is coming from, and for a lot of people and families, it's very disappointing. But like, does he want to cause a schism in the church, a split? I don't think he does. But
it is doctrine. I mean, it's a reminder of doctrine, isn't it? And this is like, what do you do? Would you bless a gay couple who came to you and said, we would like our marriage, our union blessed?
The only thing I'll say to you is, just 2 days ago, there was pieces of weed that grows on the ground, and I blessed them. I blessed shamrock. Now, if two people stand in front of me and they love each other and they're committing to each other for the rest of their lives, and I bless shamrock, and I wouldn't bless them. No. I don't think there's a doubt or a question there.
So you would?
But like, church's teaching on what marriage means and all that hasn't changed. But like, in Ireland, we're going to have a synod in the next 5 years. It's the bishops have announced it. And the bishops have said that they want people, especially on the margins, to be part of. Would any gay person come near a church that says things like this?
Look, this is a huge topic, and I'm sorry we've very little time, so this has to be my final question to you. But given that this is the doctrine which has been reaffirmed by the Vatican, where does that leave you and people like you in the Catholic Church now? As you've said, you would bless, you know, you'll bless plants, you'll bless people if you're asked.
But there's an awful difference between somebody in Rome making a promulgation and what's the lived experience of the church. And I think a lot of priests would say, like, if Christ was here with us now, what would Christ do? He would do the caring, the loving thing. He was the one who he challenged all of these rules himself. And Pope Francis is asking us to talk about these things. You know, this is the way forward, where people with different, and there's going to be an awful lot more of this in the church, which is a good thing.
All right.
It's opening things up.
Father Tim Hazelwood on Morning Ireland with Anya Lawler. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown.
I want to ask you about the publication of this Vatican document on Monday, and the former President Mary McAleese has criticised Pope Francis on the back of it, claiming that he's a populist who raises expectations only to dash them. And this is in the context of the Church still refusing to bless same-sex relationships and marriages and unions. Is Mary McAleese right on that, or is the Church right to hold firm?
Okay, I haven't seen. I just saw a brief reference on one of the websites to what former President Mary McAleese said, and I know she comes with great passion to all of these. I think it does raise the question for us as to how we deal with difficult issues, and I think that there's a sort of a part of the church that thinks if only we can shout loudly, then our truth will prevail. And Pope Francis is stuck in the middle of shrill voices from one side saying liberalise things, and shrill voices from another side saying you really ought not to betray us. We will walk away from the church if you do that. So he's trying to find some sort of truth by which we can live, because I think we have to remember that Jesus did not vie for popularity in his own day. He said some very difficult things, and people walked away from what he said. So it's simply because people do feel passionately about this.
And what did Jesus say about gay marriage?
He didn't say anything.
So why is it wrong?
Okay. The question was, should priests bless homosexual couples who ask for some type of religious recognition of their union? I think the teaching that we have from the New Testament is that marriage, and St. Paul was very clear in the letter to the Ephesians, that marriage is a sacrament, a sign of Christ's love for his church. In other words, other types of relationships exist which are not marriage. That doesn't mean we have to say everything is marriage. And there's been a strong...
And that's what St. Paul said, is it?
That's what St. Paul talked about, marriage being the husband and wife being the sacrament, the sign of Christ's love for his church. That's quite clear from the early church. Mm-hmm. So the question here really was, do you regard homosexual unions as a sacrament of Christ's love for his church? And I think Pope Francis ultimately is saying we have all sorts of respect for all sorts of relationships between people, but a homosexual relationship is not a sacrament of Christ's love for his church, as a husband and wife is.
But saying that the church doesn't have the power to bless same-sex unions because it's impossible for God to bless sin, that's not respect.
That particular sentence jarred with me a lot. I know plenty of homosexual couples with whom I would be friendly. I've no problem there. And I would never use any words that were hurtful to them. But the question is, should priests bless homosexual couples who ask for a religious recognition of their union? And that question is asked bluntly. Ultimately, the document has come down and said, sorry, we will walk with you wherever we can, but we are not going to bless that as if it were the same as marriage.
Is that right?
Well, that's what Pope Francis decide.
But what do you think?
I agree with him. I think we have to. I have plenty of people who are homosexual who are friends of mine, including people who are in same-sex relationships. And I'm happy to walk with them and be friendly with them and be as courteous and gracious.
But you'll only walk so far with them. You'll only walk so far.
You could only walk so far, not prepared to say that it is the same as the sacrament of Christ's union with his church. I mean, Christ was very clear that there are awkward truths in Christianity, and that sort of the shrill voices on either the right or the left, on the liberal or the conservative sides, are not the way forward. And this whole idea of a synod in the church, both locally and internationally, is about ensuring that the Holy Spirit leads us and not just the loudest voices. I have every respect for people, however shrill their voices may be, but I think if we're looking for the truth will very often be uncomfortable.
Is former President Mary McAleese, is her voice shrill on this issue?
Well, I think certainly there are many shrill voices going on, including within groups of clergy as well, on all sides. And I think we have to ensure that church is not a parliament. We are searching for the truth, and we are looking to make space in our prayer life for the Holy Spirit to guide us in what are difficult ways, but insulting comments, deriding other people's opinions, ridiculing other people's beliefs is not part of that process. And I hope that any document that comes from the Vatican is never seen as ridiculing anyone. But there's a very specific question here, and I think they've given a very clear answer to it. Priests are not entitled to regard homosexual couples as married in the sense of being a sacrament of Christ's relationship with his church.
Bishop of Derry, Donal McKeown, from Today with Claire Byrne. Then on the News at One, former President Mary McAleese spoke to Brian Dobson.
My problem is with the language of the explanatory memorandum. If Pope Francis and the explanatory, and the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith had merely said, look, we really don't think that offering these blessings is consistent with church teaching. And if they'd left it at that, I think, you know, I could probably have lived with that and continued to ask for, you know, some way of expressing pastoral accompaniment to people who are excluded from the church. But that's not what they did. They added an explanatory memorandum in language which is simply unacceptable. It's ugly. I mean, Bishop Donal, who was earlier on radio, Donal McKeown, said that some of the language jarred with him. Well, it's jarred with a lot of priests, it's jarred with a lot of bishops, it's even jarred with some cardinals who are expressing themselves quite volubly on the subject, saying, you know, some of them are saying that they're ashamed of their church. But to tell gay people who have been so damaged by church doctrine, which has used dreadful language that conduces to homophobia, you know, disordered, intrinsically evil, to say of gay couples, as this document does, that they cannot receive or express grace is, to me, that's the astounding thing. To say that when at the same time you say you can bless a pot plant or a pet, this is not acceptable.
The other point made by Bishop McKeown when he was speaking to Claire earlier is that the Pope, he says, is trying to steer a middle ground here between shrill voices. That was the phrase the Bishop used. There are strong views clearly on both sides, but he makes the point that the Church isn't a democracy. The Church isn't a parliament.
Yeah, does he think that? I'm 70 years old. I think I know that by now. I think most Catholics do. I don't really need that to be reiterated by anybody today. What I will say is that I agree that the Pope is hearing voices on all sides, and his job is to give leadership. It is not to ride two horses. I don't, at the same time. And he sends out messages that encouraged pastoral concern for gay people and encouraged priests and pastors to find ways of outreaching. They did, and one of the ways they wanted to outreach was to give blessings. And these are very often done quietly, they're done privately, they take 1 minute. They're simply raising the hand in the shape of the cross. That's all they are. As they do, say, to pot plants, and we have them Palm Sunday, we have it the blessing of the pets at Knock. This is not asking the Church to marry gay people in a sacramental marriage. I've never asked for that. Absolutely.
You also raise the issue in this context of church, the church role, church involvement, church control of education, and yes, talk about children being exposed to teachings that conduce to homophobia by presenting same-sex married couples as sinful. Now, is there evidence of that? Is that something we should be concerned about?
Oh, I think there is. There's huge evidence that if you just, you know, all you have to do is look at the research into school bullying in relation to homophobia, the extent of it. You only have to look at the fact that so many young gay, particularly young gay men, but not exclusively young gay men, are overrepresented by 3 times in the stats on anxiety and nervous difficulties, nerve problems with psychiatric problems, and indeed leading to suicidal ideation and suicide.
Can you lay responsibility for that at the door of the Church?
I can lay responsibility for that at the door of those who do and say things that conduce to embedded homophobia and attitudes that conduce to the hatred of homosexuals. And I can lay it at the door of any institution which claims to be created by God in order to spread love and to spread grace, and which does not do that in relation to gay men, women and children. So I think that we have big questions to ask about the catechesis that our children are exposed to. And I think that we are entitled, you know, to ask those questions in a jurisdiction where such significant input into our education comes from faith-based institutions, which are able to use language like disordered, intrinsically evil, unable to receive or express grace. This is awful language.
Just finally, Mary McAleese, you refer to those who have left the Church or who are hanging on by a thread. Are you one of those hanging on by a thread?
I referred to them because the document from the Episcopal Conference says that this synodal journey, which they are now about to embark on, this 5-year journey towards a synod, that they want to encourage, that journey will be reaching out to those people. And where I am in relation to the Church is nobody's business but my own. And so my view of it is very, very simple. We all know that there are tens of them, thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them, and worldwide, but also here, particularly in Ireland today, people who have left the Church, which is their entitlement, or who are asking themselves, should I stay or should I go? I've had, I don't know how many phone calls from those kind of people just this morning, a number of them priests and religious, who are just devastated by the way in which the institution of the Church, the institutional governance of the Church, does not support their attempts to bring Christ's love, his grace, God's grace, into the lives of people whom the Church has egregiously hurt in the past.
Former President Mary McAleese on the News at One with Brian Dobson. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Father Brian Darcy.
How are you? I'm good, Ray. I'm very good. I'm not as good as I used to be, but then I'm not as young as I used to be either. COVID did take an effect on me, and I think that, like everybody else in the world, if you're tuned into the world at all, you couldn't be right at the present time.
No.
You can be good, you can be grand, and you can be passive, but you're waiting for the world to happen again, and you're living in an expectation. If you're lucky, many others have decided, you know, that they can't live in expectation, and they live in a kind of depression, and that's thank God I'm not that way, but I do live in hope, but I'm not comfortable yet. Do you know what I mean? I'm not just comfortable in my skin yet.
And you got COVID in October.
Yes.
And do you reckon you have what they're describing now as long COVID? Do you know if you have it?
I don't know what the official title of it is, but it is improving now this last month or so. But for 3 or 4 months, it was anything but improving. The last time I was talking to you, I hadn't improved at all, because even my voice, it was an old man's voice suddenly appeared all over the place. I'm breathing, I just couldn't do it. Going upstairs, I had to stop halfway upstairs, which just wasn't me at all.
Okay.
And I'm reasonably fit. I do, you know, 5 or 6 kilometres every day. So therefore, I'm that way. But I was awfully tired and I had a foggy brain. That was the worst of it all. I just kept forgetting things. Forgetting to do things, which is, again, not like me. But you have to be patient with yourself and just say, I listen a lot, and I listen a lot to radio stations across the world. And it's the same across the world. Everybody's in this. Nobody knows the effects of COVID at all on people and what the long-term effects of it. But then again, as I keep saying, if you're here to talk about it, then you haven't had a real long-term effect of COVID. Yeah. The long-term effect of COVID are those sadly who died.
Yes. I don't know if they're COVID related, but you've done a number of funerals in the last few days.
Yes.
And I know up the north, they're allowed 25 people at a funeral, but still nowhere near the numbers who would attend a normal funeral.
No. I was doing a funeral yesterday, and it was myself and a minister from the Church of Ireland were doing a funeral. I was saying to him, gosh, you know, John, I'm finding myself having to work 3 times as hard to be a third as effective as I used to be, you know, when you're trying to do funerals and trying to bring comfort to people and trying to make people at home, trying to get to them. See, you can't even go to their house to find out things about them.
Yes,
do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
And you have to keep distance. And in the church, they're scattered all over the place. And then there's people in cars looking at you on phones. And it's a very, very difficult. You go to a graveyard and you have to say to the people, please don't come into the graveyard. Yeah. And it's just the exact opposite of we should be doing, and bereavement and grief should be. It's the exact opposite, but it's the only way we can get through it.
Father Brian Darcy on the Ray Darcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.